The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
Morning. 9 minutes after six, Wheels Up Wednesday. Eric Peters is going to be joining me here in a few minutes as we talk cars and politics and answer your questions about vehicles that the government allows us to use and those that they wish to force upon us. And we'll have that all kicking around. A lot going on. And we're going to start the show off this morning with Kevin Starrett. Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation, who woke up early. Of course, I don't know, you probably woke up like me two, three times a night just thinking about the politics. Right, Kevin? Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bill. No, I'm usually up around five, so it's just not a problem.
Yeah. Well, the reason I wanted to bring you on is that people were writing me yesterday saying, Bill, I'm trying to find out what happened with that Measure 114, the hearing, the one in which we would appear to, we being as actual sensible people, could appear to be winning at this point, but the state's appealing. This is the anti-gun lawsuit, and it has been going well so far. But there was an appeal hearing yesterday, and I was wondering if you could break that down, and it was actually hard to get a hold of what happened there, from what I understand, right?
Yeah, I've heard from a number of people who wanted to know, you know, what the decision was, and there is no decision at that level. I mean, the appeals court heard it. It's a fairly brief hearing. I think the whole thing was maybe max a half hour.
Uh-huh.
The decision will not be released for several months at least. So, you know, there's not an outcome at this point, and I've had to let people know. I mean, I've tried to make that clear in the alerts we did that there would not be a decision at that event. So it's going to be a couple of months. And I would say that it went really as well as we could expect. Tony Aiello, who was arguing for our side, was outstanding. I have to tell you, I mean, this guy is maybe the most well-prepared attorney I've ever watched. He is he's a young guy. This is kind of like some of the first major cases he's worked on. He's done an outstanding job right from the beginning where, I mean, there is not a single question or nothing that's thrown at him that he does not immediately have a response for. He doesn't have to go looking for it. He doesn't pause to think. He's really, really on top of it. The state brought the usual arguments, which, frankly, Bill, their arguments they just don't make any sense. But
what is the state actually arguing in the Measure 114 case? And what is Tony, of course, what is our side actually bringing? What is our claim, and what is the state's ridiculous claim, given that it's an anti-gun
judiciary? Without getting hyper-technical about it, at this point, I mean, the state argued originally in Harney County that the measure was constitutional, and our side said it can't possibly be constitutional. It essentially ends the future purchase of firearms and outlaws the possession of most shotguns and an integral component of a firearm, a magazine. It outlaws magazines. How can you outlaw part of a gun and say that doesn't interfere with the Second Amendment? At this point at the appeals court, since the Harney County judge found that it, in fact, was not constitutional, the appeals court, the state has a couple of positions. They say basically, well, the Harney County judge just got it wrong. Uh-huh. That, in fact, it's totally constitutional to tell people that they cannot have a integral component of a firearm.
And that everything that the stuff that you own now would be illegal, right?
Yeah,
isn't that essentially?
Like the magazines that you own now would be illegal if you left the house with them. If you own most modern shotguns would be illegal. And of course, you would be required to get a permit to purchase a gun that is not, you cannot get it. It's impossible to get because the way they created the rules in this measure said the sheriffs have to provide live fire, a mandate for live fire. Most sheriffs have no place to do that. An FBI background check that the FBI initially said, well, we won't do it at all. And then they said, well, maybe we will do it temporarily. But in any event, you talk to sheriffs. If you talk to the honest sheriffs, they'll tell you they simply do not have the means to provide these permits. So what's happened now is, in addition to just saying that, well, the state's position that the Harney County, the judge in Harney County just got it wrong, they're going back to these arguments that have been used nationally, which they simply make no sense. The main argument that's being thrown out there is that you can restrict certain items, in this case, magazines, in other cases, certain firearms. I mean, in Connecticut, they're trying to ban hunting rifles, saying they're not protected. And the argument is always that these are not appropriate things for self-defense. Well, okay, if you look at the U.S. Constitution or the Oregon Constitution, which is even more clear, the Oregon Constitution specifically says that the right of the people to keep and bear arms for defense of themselves and the state. Okay, it's crystal clear that it is not just about defending yourself personally, but it's about defending the state. And if you're defending the state, then clearly what is protected here are militia or military style firearms. And the same thing is true for the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which says a well-regulated militia. Now, militias are fighting forces, and to suggest that the only thing they're allowed to have is a 5 or 6 shot revolver when facing off against a military enemy is on its face absurd. But this is the argument that the government has been using around the country. So they use that argument, and they use the argument that we can ban certain things because they're used in crime. So the argument of the state is that standard capacity magazines have been used in mass shootings, therefore we can ban them. They've said in other cases that semi-automatic rifles have been used in mass shootings, and so there's a public interest in banning them. The problem is the Supreme Court has already said you cannot use that test. You cannot use what they call a balancing test, meaning, okay, the state has an interest in banning something because it's good for the people.
Yeah, but isn't one of the challenges, though, that many of the states, and it would appear that Oregon would like to ignore the Supreme Court of the United States with the Bruin decision? Isn't this what they're trying to do with these kind of claims?
They are doing it. I mean, in our federal case against Measure 114, the federal judge just blatantly and openly ignored the Bruin decision and, in fact, invoked this balancing act. But think about where you could go with this. If you can ban anything that's used in a crime, you can ban anything.
Well, you could use credit cards. Credit cards get used in crime too. Let's see, cars get used in crime. In fact, clothing. You know, people wear clothing when they go out and they commit crimes. And gosh, you can ban clothes too. Why not? I know it's absurd, but you know that's where you can take this. It's an absurd point.
What's really dangerous is that this concept that the only things that are protected are things that are used in self-defense is an argument that in many cases, lawyers on our side of the issue have basically been accepting and saying, okay, well, we have proof that this device or that device actually is used in self-defense.
That's kind of a dumb take. That's been dumb for the pro-Second Amendment side to be taking that you could ban something if it's not used in self-defense. That's ridiculous on its face.
Well,
Because I'm sure a howitzer properly applied could be used for self-defense. I know that I'm going to absurd levels once again, but in other words, the only thing that is legal for us to have is something that has been used for self-defense. That's insane, Kevin. It's just insanity.
Right, and it's not only that something could be used for self-defense. It's something that commonly is. So, for example, in our federal case, the judge said, well, we can ban magazines over 10 rounds because in most self-defense shootings, the number of rounds used are 2.2. Now, with that logic, of course,
okay,
is you could ban magazines that hold more than 2.2 rounds. And so the courts have been coming and saying, we demand that you bring to us large examples, large numbers of examples of situations where more than 10 rounds were used. Well, that makes zero sense because it's not our job. Their job is to demonstrate that there's a history of these kind of regulations. We have no responsibility under the Supreme Court decision to prove anything. And if you extend the logic that the average number of rounds is what we use to determine what you can own, then in fact you can own a firearm that shoots 3 rounds. It makes zero sense. It doesn't comport in any way with our constitutions. And the fact that it's accepted by attorneys on our side, I can only assume it's because you get into a hearing in the legislature and you can make a case for whether or not a particular law makes sense. You can't really do that in court. In court, you have to demonstrate whether it's a good idea or a bad idea that it is, in fact, constitutional or unconstitutional. And granted, very often people get it wrong. The arguments in courts are very, very different. And I suppose in defense of attorneys who are accepting this argument, if you've got a judge who's just said, hey, in my courtroom, this is the rule we're going by, they do the best they can.
So, yeah, you're not going to screw against the judge or come out against the judge because you'll be in big trouble and your case is in real serious jeopardy. Fair enough.
Well, and there's
that
also,
kind of thing.
There's political considerations. You know, a number of years ago, in another groundbreaking Second Amendment case, the Heller decision in D.C., the attorney in that case, a guy named Gura, I spoke to him in Cincinnati years ago. And during that case, which we all thought was kind of groundbreaking, which basically threw out some of D.C.'s most restrictive gun laws, he specifically pointed out in his case that he was not defending machine guns. Now, the reason he made that decision, in fact, the Second Amendment and previous Supreme Court decisions going back to the 1930s, the Miller decision in the 30s said the only thing that's protected are military firearms. Mm-hmm. And yet, when he was arguing the Heller case in D.C., he made it a point to say we're not defending machine guns. And I asked him why. I mean, clearly there's a precedent for saying that only military guns are protected. And he was said, look, man, it's Washington, D.C. The judges in Washington, it's a political thing. They're never going to accept that, even though it's perfectly logical and rational, just as accepting the fact that Oregon's Constitution says, black letter, that we are allowed to have guns to defend the state. And if those guns – in any rational person's mind would have to be the kind of firearms that a soldier carries. So I think we've kind of gotten into trouble with this, with, you know, except, okay, now we're going to come and have all these examples of when an AR-15 was used in self-defense, which of course exists, but that's not our job. And that's not the point. And since in many cases, you know, any judge that demands those kind of examples is almost going to certainly find against you anyway, and you're going to have to appeal it. It is unclear to me, and maybe some smart attorney out there can explain it. It's unclear to me why our side just doesn't say to the judges, look, it's not our problem. The state has to come up with this, and the state can't come up with it because the Constitution's crystal clear.
Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation, and we're talking about the hearing yesterday of Measure 114, and this is the state case. And would you say overall, I just want to reiterate that it seemed to go well for the Second Amendment's case, you know, for the side, you know, for our side, the gun owner's side of this thing, or not? Is there anything that was revolutionary or anything that was just astounding that made you roll your eyes or were shocked about? I'm just trying to get it because it was only a short hearing. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, they're typically very short. I think the one thing that really stood out to me was when the state said that it's okay to ban magazines because they're not arms. And one of the judge very pointedly responded and said, well, wait a minute, they're components of arms, are they not? And the state's lawyer interestingly said, well, yes, they are. And then immediately said, no, they're not.
You know,
it's like saying, look, I can't, as a judge, we can't ban guns, but we can ban barrels because a barrel is not a gun. And we can ban triggers because a trigger's not a gun.
Yeah, but try to have a gun and fire it without a trigger or a barrel. Fair enough.
Yeah, or a magazine. And the state's position is, well, you know, it's possible to operate a magazine-fed firearm with a magazine that holds fewer than 10 rounds. And, well, yeah, that's true. But it's also possible to operate many magazine-fed firearms with no magazine at all. So why not? I mean, you can fire an AR-15 rifle with no magazine, and there are some guns, particularly handguns, that have devices in them that don't allow them to operate unless there's a magazine. They're considered safeties. But for the most part, magazine-fed firearms can be loaded one round at a time. It's absurd, and it defeats the purpose, but it can be done. I believe it was the same judge. It was kind of hard to tell which judge was speaking because the connections were not wonderful. Mm-hmm. But you know, the same judge said, well, wait a minute, one of the judges said, you know, in the early days, there were firearms that could fire multiple rounds, whether or not. So my impression, and I think it's a bad idea to try to make predictions of what courts are going to decide based on how the hearing goes. But my impression was that the questions that the judges asked were actually quite thoughtful, more so than I've seen elsewhere.
That's good.
Thoughtful and respectful. And as I said, Tony Aiello knocked it out of the park. I mean, he just did a fantastic job.
All right. I appreciate knowing that, Kevin. And I appreciate the report here, too. You know, I wanted to ask about the judges, because I've been trying to raise an issue here in Southern Oregon. Do all those judges, do you know what the history of the judges that were on the Court of Appeals, or the people that were heard in front of yesterday? Were all of those judges originally appointed by Democrat governors? Because I'm trying to raise this issue of the judicial scam. And it's happening here in Oregon, you know, because we just had a new judge position created in the circuit court, the 11th Circuit. And Governor Kotek ended up choosing Matt Rowan to fill a judgeship for 60 days prior to an election. And we know how this scam works, in which you handpick your favorite candidate. And so that person gets to run as an incumbent. Most people don't know much about the judicial runs. And then we have Johan Pietila, who's challenging him, who was not chosen by the governor, who has to try to make the case. And I'm trying to tell people, we have to get to the point where we stop letting the governors choose our judges, period.
I haven't. The history of and the biographies of the judges are available on their websites. I don't want to claim that I know the history of all three of these female judges. I do not, but it's available. But it is true that it's rare for a judge to actually be elected in any kind of legitimate election. As you said, what they do is they always retire a few months before their term is over, which allows a liberal governor to appoint their replacement. That person runs as an incumbent, and it's rare for anyone to run against an incumbent. It just doesn't happen.
Because if you lose, you end up destroying your career if you have to go in front of that judge. You're just done as an attorney.
Very possibly. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, most people who are running for office will have information, whether it's true or not, available either on their websites, that'll be in the voters' guides and stuff, which gives you some indication of where they stand. Like, for example, the people who are running for office in Oregon now, the people who are running for treasurer and the people who are running for Secretary of State, the Democrats are very openly extreme leftists. You can look at their endorsements. You can look at their history, and you know for the most part what you're getting if they've served in office, because you kind of have a history of their votes. If they're running for the first time, they can say anything. But it's almost impossible to get any information about a judge. And it would be very, very difficult to research their decision in previous cases. They're not going to answer any questions. So if someone's running for, even in a contested election, if you were to contact somebody who is running for a judge's role in a contested election, say, hey, can you tell me where you stand on this issue or that issue? They're not going to answer you. So what do you get? And we kind of have that same situation now where, you know, we've got a race for attorney general. And all the Republican legislators are sending out emails saying, vote for Will Lathrop. He's the law and order Republican guy.
Right.
But Will Lathrop will not answer where he stands on Measure 114. He won't say what he'll do. And so we kind of have that same situation. Of course, he's not in office. So.
And by the way, I'm going to talk to him on Friday morning.
Well, you know, if you can get him to take a stand, because, I had a conversation yesterday. I was on with another talk show, and they contacted him, and the response they got in writing was Harris-style word salad. You know, I had a back and forth with an elected House rep about this issue yesterday, and his position was, well, look, the guy's got to get elected. Okay. Well, if he honestly believes that most people will vote against him unless he supports this unconstitutional law, then if he does get elected, how is he going to oppose it? And, you know, I understand political reality, mm-hmm. but it also seems like a lot of these people say, the Republicans say, we've got to pander to the Democrats to get their votes. And we don't owe any explanation to Republican voters. We don't they're not deserving of. And even on an issue as volatile as this, which passed by less than one percentage point and is so draconian, many people who voted for it now regret that. What a great opportunity for a candidate who's running for attorney general to say, look, I've looked at this thing. It's dangerous. It makes no sense. My job as attorney general is to be the voice, the legal voice of the people. And, you know, we can no longer spend millions of your tax dollars defending it. But he won't do it.
I appreciate that. And, well, I'm going to ask him on Friday, see what he has to say. And if we get a word salad, I guess that's an answer, too. It does concern me because whether you're a Republican, whether you're a Democrat running for attorney general, Measure 114 would essentially ban firearm sales in the state of Oregon. So tell me, how can anybody explain this to me, you know, in a fashion that says that, well, yeah, that's okay with the Second Amendment. It's okay with the Second Amendment. And half the stuff that you have in your gun safe would not be legal to take out of your home. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this should not be that hard to answer for anybody who's running for either.
No, it really shouldn't be. I mean, it's not as though, okay, I'm a politician, I want to get elected. The people passed this with 70% of the vote. It's obviously what the people want. It was 50.6%, and it wasn't passed. It was passed as, you know, the people have passed a lot of ballot measures that they realized were a terrible mistake. I mean,
Measure 110, classic example, right?
Okay, because they were sold a bill of goods and said, oh, this is going to be for rehabilitation, and it was a lie. And they were sold a bill of goods on Measure 114 because, of course, the cartel media said, oh, this is all about safety and your kids are going to be safe. It was a bunch of crap. It was lies. But when it's a ballot measure and there isn't an opportunity for, I mean, I remember when we were fighting that ballot measure, the digital ads that we wanted to run, the electronics refused to run them. I mean, you cannot get the truth out in a ballot measure. And in this case, it is pretty clear. I mean, judges already found it unconstitutional that a candidate for attorney general should be able to take the position that, look, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I've looked at this. It doesn't make any sense to deny Oregonians the right to protect themselves in an environment where our rules have already made crime skyrocket. I mean, you know, right now, they're just assuming there are going to be riots in Portland. You know, that's the OPB's, you know, headline today.
And by the way, they're moving OSP officers up to Portland, too. You have that on good authority, from what I understand?
Yeah, no, I have it on excellent authority that the state troopers are being taken off the road and being redeployed to Portland in anticipation of riots.
Well, I'm sure that all of the police officers will be using firearms that have 2.3 rounds, you know, the maximum number of rounds needed to take on miscreants like that.
Well, look, in Portland, the police are not allowed to use firearms at all.
I mean, when you look at the
letter that was just put out by a bunch of Democrats in Portland saying that they hope to uphold our tradition of respectful civic participation during this election season. What
civic participation, meaning burning the city down again? Another dumpster fire or two, right?
I mean, you know, if you're a cop in Portland and someone throws a bag of urine at your face and you smack them with a baton, you lose your job and are forced to apologize. This is what's happening. And so the criminals have taken over the cities and the state, you know, the legislators jointly are doing everything they can to make sure that you as a resident of Oregon do not have the means to protect yourself or your family. And of course, you know, in cases across the country, the courts are going along for the ride. Now, I have to say, in many cases, the courts are finding in favor of gun ownership. The problem is, of course, is the state, federal and local authorities.
Well, they're able to take our tax money and continue to fight us on this,
you know, forever. And mm-hmm. So that, you know, that brings us back to this whole attorney general thing, is that how much longer will this fight go on? And of course, keep in mind, as I think I've mentioned in the past, irrespective of what happens with the court and Measure 114, nothing stops the legislature from coming back in January and just enacting all of this as a law. And even if the courts find it unconstitutional, the legislature can just rewrite it and say, really?
And then the legal battle starts again, Then it starts all over again. All right.
Exactly.
All right, Kevin, I appreciate the update. OregonFirearms.org to stay up on this, sign up for the alerts, and please help out, too, because you know, it's one of the big organizations that's fighting this. And thank you for getting up early this morning to talk about it, okay? Be well.
Thank you, Bill. You take care.
All right. 633 KMED, 99.3 KBXG. Wheels Up Wednesday continues with Eric Peters after news.
At Pressure Point Roofing, your home is our passion. From your initial call...
Randy Sparacino for Jackson County Commissioner. Paid for by Sparacino for Oregon, ID 20676.
This is News Talk 106.3 KMED. And you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
It's just getting crazier. Wheels Up Wednesday. Eric Peters, automotive journalist and genius from epautos.com, is on. Eric, welcome back. Great to hear from you this morning. How are things?
Well, I'm feeling reasonably good this morning because I kind of see an orange glow in the distance, but I guess we're going to find out, a couple of weeks from now when they finally determine who won the election.
And then I think no matter who ends up winning it, I'll put it in scary air quotes, there will be many challenges and lots of lawsuits. Lots of lawyering going on. And I'm sure, you know, Portland will be half burned down and mostly peaceful protesting, you know, that kind of thing. By the way, I guess the latest I heard about, did you hear about the, you know, the ballot boxes that burned in Portland and in Vancouver, Washington? Did you hear about that story?
I did, and I saw something. I haven't had a chance to look into it deeply, so I don't know whether it's accurate, about non-English-speaking people being bused en masse to various polling places and shunted to the front of the lines.
I haven't heard about that part of it, but we did find out that the incendiary device, according to authorities, at least the one in Portland, had Free Gaza on it. So that's... part of it. So anyway, as we move along here, if you're feeling like a pile of garbage this morning, it could be because the current chief executive of the United States doesn't have a very high opinion of you, Eric.
The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters.
Yep. So that's the latest coming out of the Biden thing. Meanwhile, you have Joe talking about us all being a pile of garbage. Meanwhile, Kamala.
I have been honored to serve as Joe Biden's vice president.
So she's been honored to serve the man who calls half the
country. Yeah, who called half the country. I got that bite from Hugh Hewitt this morning. And I think the best bite, the best sound bite of the day, though, has to do with this particular one.
I pledge to listen to experts.
Remember the experts that shut us all down? Remember everything?
And, you know, one of the things that just gets my back up about these people is their kumbaya language. They want to listen. You know, it's like we're all sitting around a campfire somewhere where, you know, some smelly hippie is strumming a guitar and we're all singing songs together.
Yep. And nothing really changes. And the experts, you know, experts have been coming under a lot of fire over the last few years for good reason, because quite often they're not really experts as much as they are knowing how to work the political angle of the administrative state. I think that's really what we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's become apparent. And in a way, that is a blessing, because, you know, we did used to live in this high-trust society where it was assumed that these so-called experts actually were, and that, more importantly, that they were objective and that they actually were conveying facts, whereas now it's very obvious that they peddle lies, and they do it in a malicious and deliberate manner. And now we are in a low-trust society. And in a way, I think that that's good, because instead of just reflexively listening and following orders, people now sit and wait and think, let me look into this myself and find out what the truth is, rather than just assume I'm being told the truth.
Yeah, white coat is not trusted as much as it once were. And that could be good, depending on how the white coat's being trained, all right? Hey, one of the articles that I was just chuckling over yesterday on EP Autos, by the way, Eric Peters is with me this morning. If you wanted to talk with him and ask him a question about vehicles and politics and more, 770-5633. You have an article that I was just loving, and it's called Champions of Diversity, right? And the moment I say that, diversity, DEI, it's like, oh my gosh, what kind of nonsense do we have here? And it has to do with the politicizing of the automotive press. And this is something really got you hot and bothered. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with this?
Sure. I'll preface it by saying that's their term, not mine. I didn't come up with that headline. That's literally the term that they use. It's this kumbaya language again. Champions. You know, we're of a piece with celebrating. You know, we're all supposed to be really excited and jazzed about all of this woke ideological stuff. Well, it was about an article that appeared in Automotive News, which at one time was a trade journal, meaning, you know, it talked about what was going on in the car business. You know, is Ford going to open a plant here? What are the unions doing? It was very matter of fact.
Yeah, and it was also people probably that that had gasoline in their veins back then, too, who were at least interested in the automotive industry. Fair enough.
Well, yeah, and it was literally not editorializing. It was just a trade journal. You know, if you're in any of the trades, I'm in the car trade, you know, you get these journals and they tell you what's kind of inside baseball going on within the business. You know, cut and dry. It's not really something that was intended to appeal to people outside of the trade. Well, anyway, now they're talking about this kind of stuff, about how wonderful it is that the automakers are so focused on making sure that they have the right number of people of the right color, except one color, and the right sex, except the male sex, and anybody who isn't heterosexual.
And so they actually put these all these pictures up to just show how diverse we are, right?
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if we're competent about it. It doesn't matter if we're actually manufacturing vehicles that people want and or can afford. That doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, that's my point. Shouldn't we be celebrating competence and excellence in engineering, let's say? Oh, look, here's Joe Smith or whatever their name is, or whether it's a woman, who cares? But look, they designed this absolutely magnificent engine or a component or something like that. Yeah, I'll celebrate that. I'm not going to celebrate the fact that somebody was born a certain color or has certain equipment between their legs.
Yeah. Well, this kind of takes me to the next one that you have in here. It's sort of a 1-2 punch. You have an article about Volkswagen. Of course, Volkswagen,
yep.
I have two Volkswagens, so I've always been a fan of Volkswagen cars, and yeah, they were quirky and weird. They had their proclivities. I mean, you and I both had the old air-cooled ones. I still have a really old camper and a not-so-old Passat, but, you know, both, you know, we enjoy them. We enjoy them a lot.
Yeah.
And to see what's been done to Volkswagen and what Volkswagen, I think, has allowed to have done to it, I think, didn't really fight back after the diesel scandal here. But you call it an admission of defeat, and it's what the new Scout is. Now, I remember the old Scout, the International Scout.
Mm-hmm.
It was a stout, great vehicle that you could get for a pretty reasonable price. Not an SUV. What would you have called
it? It was a 4x4.
Just a 4x4. 4x4, and it was just good stuff, and I have great memories of people with the International Scout. So what is the new Scout going to be?
Well, you can probably guess. What happened was that Volkswagen bought the rights to the name Scout, and they decided to festoon another battery-powered device with that, which is sad and pathetic in that it's another example of them trying to leverage, not just Volkswagen, the industry. They've got nothing that people want, so they're trying to leverage nostalgia. You know, people remember the Scout, and they think, wow, what a great vehicle. And then they hear it's being brought back, and so initially they're like, wow, that's great. I'd love to have a new one. And then they find out it's a battery-powered device. And it gets better. In order to make this thing even somewhat sort of viable, it's going to carry around a gas-fired generator. They call that a range extender.
Ah! Oh no! That to me says it all. All right, you want to buy a 4x4? You want to go out in the middle? But we know darn well that a battery-powered vehicle is just not going to be practical. It doesn't work, right? Doesn't work, unless you're by the charging station. So they just build another engine into it. All right,
right. It's cartoon silly. And of course, what happens when one of these electric 4x4s gets its battery pack punctured by a rock? You know, as it's trying to crawl over something, boom, then it lights on fire.
Well, it'll set the forest on fire, and then the forest will be restored. It's what the fans of burning the forest around here always like to call it, Eric.
Yeah, and it's the circling around the drain just picks up speed all the time. You know, you get into the nitty-gritty, and the CEO of this the Scout subsidiary, you know, Volkswagen is the one that's pouring the money into this.
Oh, okay, so it's not actually a Volkswagen, but it's going to be a separate line, like Ram is a separate line, that kind of thing, or Ram trucks.
Yeah, and the ironic thing is Volkswagen is literally teetering on the edge of the abyss right now with bankruptcy, and yet it's pouring money into this thing, which has got the people in Germany extremely unhappy for obvious reasons.
Well, yeah, Volkswagen's a big deal. Yeah, Volkswagen goes down, a lot of people are out of work in Germany. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, it's potentially disastrous. And then this guy that they put in charge of Scout has the gall, the effrontery, or maybe he's just delusional, to talk about how this is the connection machine, this device called Scout, when there's nothing connected at all to anything. It's an electric device. It's not like in the old Scout where you had a lever that actually engaged physically the four-wheel drive. And maybe you got out and locked the hubs.
People
remember that.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you push a button, and all you're doing is sending a signal to a computer, and the computer tells the thing to do whatever it is. It's an app that moves. It's the least connected thing imaginable.
But still, the range extender. This reminds me so much of, I don't know if I told you the story a number of months ago. I was talking about what the military was doing, was exploring the electric tank. They wanted EV tanks. Do you remember that? Okay, they wanted EV tanks. They want electric vehicle tanks out there on the battlefield. But you need a charger to charge the electric tanks on the battlefield. So what they're going to do is take jet fuel and put it in a generator. You know, put a turbine engine on it and then generate the power and charge up the tank. Well, wouldn't it be easier and much more effective and efficient just to take the jet fuel and put it in the tank and run the tank, you know?
It's the real life incarnation of the Rube Goldberg device. You know, those cartoons people are probably familiar with, where a guy develops this elaborate apparatus to do some extremely simple task.
Yeah. But then you go out there and you say it's a zero emission tank as you're, you know, blowing up Gaza or something. I don't know. But
the other thing I want to
make your teeth hurt. I'm sorry.
The other thing about the Scout is that it was affordable. You know, it was a vehicle that blue collar people could afford when it was new. It cost about $3,400 back in 1974.
Okay, so $3,400 for a Scout then. What will the new electric vehicle version of Scout cost?
Well, okay, so the $3,400 in 74 works out to about $23,000 today, which is what you pay for, you know, a base level Toyota Camry, let's say, or a loaded Corolla. So, you know, very affordable. Well, they're talking about now, this isn't supposed to come out till 2027, so, you know, you can imagine what the actual price is going to be, but they claim it's going to start around $60,000. Now, even if that's true, that's still almost three times as much as what the thing cost back in the day.
I would add another $10,000 at least to what it will really be by that time. I think about $70,000 is probably where it's going to start.
So it is literally the parking brake 180 opposite of everything that the original Scout was and stood for. It's another one of these high-end, high-priced vehicles that's incidentally electric for the very affluent people who can afford to indulge it.
Okay, well, since we are talking about the push for EVs, they're still pushing it even though people have been turning them down. Why is it, in fact, you have an article called Some Questions for the Apologists, which kind of go down there, why are we being restricted on which ones we're allowed to buy?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to puncture some balloons with that one, you know, because they tell us that it's very necessary that we transition, that's the word they love to use, to electric vehicles, because there is an existential threat looming, meaning there's an emergency. You know, the climate is changing, whatever that means. But the thing is, you know, we're all going to die real soon if we don't get into these EVs really quickly. Well, if that's the case, then why are they preventing low-cost EVs from, say, China from coming in? Well, the unions don't like it because it might cost jobs. And, of course, the so-called legacy automakers might not like it because it's a competitive problem for them. But if we're in an existential crisis, who cares about those things?
Well, you know, it's like you know darn well why it's not an existential crisis. It's just being used as a cudgel to get people out of personal transportation. That's what this is all about.
Well, that's my point. That's why I'm trying to get people to see that, because I think a lot of people have been lulled by this EV hypnotism stuff. And when you really look at it, it's a supremely obnoxious thing, because ultimately it's an elitist thing. Look at how much these things cost in this country, the ones that people are allowed to buy. The least expensive of them on the very low end are around $30,000, which is a hell of a lot to pay for a little tiny basic car.
Sure.
And, you know, you move up the food chain, and they typically cost $50,000 and up. So what they're doing basically is trying to transition the market over into a market where only people who can afford to spend essentially BMW and Mercedes and Lexus money are going to be in any position to be able to buy a vehicle anymore.
And remember politics, Eric.
I pledge to listen to experts.
Yep. You know darn well she'd be listening to those existential threat experts, right?
Yeah,
she'd be
doing that. Like Pete Buttigieg,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Okay. Hey, Eric, before we wrap up here, I just wanted to say what I love about reading EP Autos is that in spite of these challenges that we're talking about, in which everything that is happening to the automotive world right now is because of the attacks on government. It's not about the market. If there was they were willing up to recently to build what people wanted, but now it's kind of like everything's compliance cars. Now, I'm looking at your review for this week, And I think this is one of those interesting vehicles which you have a bit of your compliance cake, but you can eat it too. And
yes.
That is the 2025 Kia Sportage. Could you tell us about the review?
This sure. is not I kind of did this with a wink and a nod.
Yeah,
you know, this vehicle,
exactly.
This is a plug-in hybrid. And what I love about the plug-in hybrid is it's a way for a manufacturer, not just Kia, but all the other manufacturers that are doing this, to deal with the issue of compliance, because this is a vehicle that can be plugged in and that can operate as an electric vehicle for about 35 miles. So, you know, the government looks at that and, oh, you know, that helps with compliance.
Well, you know, and that would work for someone like me. I mean, my drive to work is only about 3.5 miles. It's not very far at all. So 7 mile round trip, maybe 8 or 9 if I go see my mom, you know, kind of easy. And that would work for a lot of people, wouldn't it?
But the best thing is you don't have to plug it in. See, that's the brilliant thing about it. You know, they offer it. You can if you want to, and that's great. But if you don't want to, you never have to plug the thing in because it operates like a conventional hybrid when you don't, meaning that as you drive, the engine will cycle on and off periodically, and it will put some charge into the battery. And then when you roll up to, say, a stop, the engine will cut off, and the battery will then power some of the accessories. And so you can drive it as a conventional vehicle, and it has about a 400-mile range on account of that. So it's a way for you to just have a normal car that you don't have to plan your life around, which is what's great about it.
Now, what happened? I remember General Motors had, was it the Cruze that was their plug-in hybrid back in the day? Was it?
The Volt.
Oh, the Volt, which I thought was actually a pretty good idea, but they stopped production of that, did they not?
Yeah, well, they did because its timing was kind of off. At the time, the compliance regime was not as ferocious as it has become. And, of course, back in those days, you know, gas still cost, what, I think $1.40 or something when that thing came out. So it really, the savings that you got by driving it really didn't efface what you had to spend to get it, which is really the one thing about these plug-in hybrids that's problematic is that they are expensive. You know, in the case of this Kia, the price difference is, I think, about $10,000 versus the comparably equipped version of it that isn't a plug-in hybrid.
I guess one of the challenges will be if someone's going to go buy the plug-in hybrid version of the Kia Sportage, you then start doing the calculation. Okay, it's like $10,000-$12,000 more than the non-version, the non-hybrid version, and then you start thinking, okay, how many gallons of gas would that end up buying? You know, that $10,000 or $12,000, isn't that the case?
Yes, but they're variables. You know, who knows what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks or months? What if gas goes up to $8 a gallon?
Well, then a plug-in hybrid looks pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, right? Or it becomes unavailable. You know, literally. I mean, what if you get to the point where you sporadically can't get gas? Well, at least you can still plug this thing in, and it will go 35 miles. And for most people, or for a lot of people anyway, that's enough to get you to the store and back or get you to work and back.
Yeah, and that would work. You plug it in, and you can get to the point. I knew some people that had that, you know, the plug-in hybrid from GM that you were talking about a few years ago that talked about how their gasoline would end up going sour,
true. Yeah, because if that thing would go about 50 miles on its batteries before the gas engine came on as a generator. And yeah, you know, I mean, if you didn't drive more than 50 miles a day, that tank full of gas might be sitting in there for months.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a 657. So overall, was your impression of the Kia Sportage pretty good?
Yeah. I mean, Kia makes some really, really top shelf vehicles. And one of the interesting things about it, too, you know, Kia and Hyundai used to be kind of the butt of jokes, like they were considered to be synonymous with sort of like cheap, low end vehicles. Well, you ought to go see one of these things and sit inside of it in particular and look at it. And it's very easy to imagine a three-pointed star or a BMW spinner and, you know, looking at you in the steering wheel hub, because there just really isn't that much difference anymore between the much more expensive luxury brands and a mass market brand like Kia or Hyundai, for that matter.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times when it comes to automotive technology, right? You got it.
Yep.
Let me talk with, let's go to line two here. You got a question for Eric Peters. Welcome, caller. You're on.
Good morning. This is Vicky from the Applegate.
Vicky, fire away. Got a quick one for Eric? Let's hear it.
I actually, you know, when you turn, I don't have cell service, but when I turn my phone on when I go to town, I get all like the little snidbits of news stories and stuff. And I actually saw a snidbit of something that said 1972 to 1976 for Ford Couriers, there's an issue with the front driver's tire. Mm-hmm. And because I don't have cell service, I didn't get to see what it actually said. So have you heard anything about that?
Okay, Eric, have you heard anything about Vicky's museum piece there?
Well, that's a tire. I mean, that would be not the vehicle per se, but the tire manufacturer. And now it's 50 years in the rear, more than that. It's more than 50 years old, so it couldn't possibly be whatever the original equipment tire was.
And maybe it's a wheel or suspension thing that you're talking about. Maybe that's what you're talking about. You misheard that.
I would delve into that a little bit more. I doubt it's got anything to do with the vehicle because of the time at this point.
All right. Well, Vicki, we appreciate that. You can also write Eric, and you can just go to the website and write Eric if you have questions like that, too. But I love it when people call here for you.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to review next week, my friend? It'll be the post-election apocalypse vehicle of some sort or another.
Right? No, we got a crossover SUV. We've got the Lincoln Corsair that's coming, which is essentially a nicer Lincoln-badged version of the Ford Escape.
All right. Well, you're going to give us a post-election analysis, too. We're going to find out if people are saddling up Wednesday morning. Okay? You'll know.
Yep, assuming I'm not firing the 50 cal to keep out the Golden Horde.
Okay. All right, Eric, you take care. We'll talk soon, all right?
You too, Bill. Thank you.
EPautos.com. Shade before 7 o'clock. This is KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass.
We're here with Susan, who had her welder up by Clouser Drilling. Susan.